Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 157, The Psychology of Second Life, June 6, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
It's one of the most compelling things about Second Life and other virtual worlds is this effect where you take control of an avatar. That's how you navigate in Second Life and other virtual worlds. You have what's called an avatar, which is from the Sanskrit word for godly incarnation. And you get to control what it looks like, what gender it's going to be. And really, so that's kind of your way of expressing yourself in Second Life. And that kind of forces people to think about things that they don't generally think about. They think about, you know, what would be their ideal version of themselves, or what do they want to show to the world?
That was the voice of my guest, Wagner James Au, who is author of the 2008 book, The Making of Second Life, Notes from the New World. From April 2003 to February 2006, he was a contract writer for Linden Lab, creators of Second Life, primarily hired by the company to cover Second Life as an embedded journalist in an emerging society. Its controversies, its personalities, its innovations and ambitions, along with larger themes of identity, social norms, organization, and cultural expression important to online worlds in general. That contractual relationship has ended, but the story continues in his book and his New World Notes blog. He's been interviewed about his work as the embedded journalist for Second Life by CNN, NPR's All Things Considered, the BBC, the Los Angeles Times, Harvard Business Review, News.com, the San Jose Mercury, the Associated Press, Wired Online, Press Time, and East Bay Express, among other publications. He's spoken on this subject at the South by Southwest event in Austin, Texas, and twice he's presented at the State of Play Conference, which is sponsored by Yale University and New York Law School. Now, here's the interview. Wagner James Au, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Doctor.
Well, I'm so glad to have you here because I have just finished reading your wonderful book, The Making of Second Life, Notes from the New World. And you were an embedded journalist in Second Life.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And so maybe we should start off, just in case I have some listeners. It seems unlikely, but just in case there's somebody who might not know what we're talking about, give us the top line on what Second Life is.
Yeah, and actually I think most people are still at that point of, I've heard of it, but I haven't heard the whole story. So really what Second Life is, it's a online 3D virtual world that is entirely user-created with building tools. So what you see is looks like a 3D world, sort of similar to what you'd see like in a video game or a computer game like World of Warcraft, but instead of everything being created by the company, everything you see in Second Life, all the buildings and the clothing and the vehicles, all of that is made by the users of Second Life.
Okay, well that's a good description. Now, as a journalist, I got the impression that you tried to be as objective as you could and to stand outside the fray because there were various things going on in that world that could tug you one way or another. Was that hard for you to do?
Yeah, I mean, it was difficult in several ways. Well, one of the ways is when I first started out as an embedded journalist, I was a contractor with Linden Lab, the company behind Second Life. They created the software that runs it and also the servers that run Second Life. And they brought me in as a contract writer to go in and just say, they told me, well, look, explore this place. I think there's a community of people kind of forming up. This was in 2003. So, I was a contractor with them, so they were paying me. They weren't paying me to write fluff. They were actually pretty serious about saying, go in and write about the controversies and the larger issues that come up with having a user-created world. So that was one issue. And then the other issue, of course, is, yeah, there's going to be, like any society, there's going to be conflicts between the users. In Second Life, they're called residents. And so there is conflicts, anything from kind of interpersonal arguments to full-fledged virtual wars where they're shooting each other with machine guns and tanks and giant robots and things like that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there are so many aspects to Second Life and to your book that we could explore, because there are business dimensions with people mm-hmm. carrying on businesses and making money both in-world and out-of-world, and what all the implications are of that for the future of commerce. There are political right. dimensions. It's almost like a little laboratory for politics, mm-hmm. and there are sociological dimensions and philanthropic dimensions. But
oh, yeah.
But what I want to focus on today is the psychological, because it's a very psychological place.
Yeah, I think, and this is one of the most compelling things about Second Life and other virtual worlds, is this effect where you take control of an avatar. That's how you navigate in Second Life and other virtual worlds. You have what's called an avatar, which is from the Sanskrit word for godly incarnation. And you get to control what it looks like, what gender it's going to be. And really, so that's kind of your way of expressing yourself in Second Life. And that kind of forces people to think about things that they don't generally think about. They think about, you know, what would be their ideal version of themselves, or what do they want to show to the world? And so it starts there, and then you have, again, with gender, and, you know, how are you going to express yourself in terms of, you know, if you want to go in and be romantic, and how are you going to have feelings related to that when it's an avatar you're controlling? It's like a 3D character that you see right in front of your screen and you control with the keyboard and the mouse. But the thing is, what seems to happen is there is a transference of identity where you are, the fact that you're controlling it, and you control also what it looks like, it also kind of associates you with it. And there's been some really interesting studies from Stanford especially about this whole effect, where a guy named Nick Yee, he was at the time a graduate student at Stanford, he did some studies, for example, with body space and eye contact in Second Life. And I mentioned this in the book, The Making of Second Life, that he noticed that he and his volunteers, that we have the same sense of personal space and eye contact in Second Life that we do in real life. So your avatar will tend to stay the same distance from other avatars, especially whether they're male or female, that they would in real life. And these are all these unwritten social rules that we have in the real world, and somehow they transfer over to our avatars.
Oh, that's fascinating. Actually, yeah. I've been wanting to get in touch with Nick Yee, because I've interviewed, and actually a good friend of mine from graduate school was his major professor, I think, as an undergraduate at Swarthmore, I believe it was, Dr. Doug Davis. And so Doug had been telling me about his research, actually, in several conversations. And so I was, it reminded me of that when I ran across your reference to him in the book.
I'd be happy to introduce
you. Yeah, I agree with you that identity is a big issue in this space. You know, to prepare for this interview, I decided that I would take the plunge. And so I went into Second Life.
Right.
And I agonized over, well, what name did I want to have, and what kind of persona did I want to present? What did I want my avatar to look like? And so it really does confront one right away with a lot of questions about identity. And what it put me in touch with is, you know, in psychology, sometimes we talk about the persona, which refers to the social mask that we all wear. Mm-hmm. And in Second Life, that same process is just made more explicit. You're a bit more conscious that you're about to put on a mask, and you really make a conscious decision. What do I want this mask to be?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And whether you want that mask to be an entirely kind of fanciful fictional representation, so it's more like a role-playing persona, or whether you want it to be kind of your stand-in. So people have debates whether they want to put, for example, their real-life name in their profile in Second Life. They could say, oh, in real life, I'm, you know, Dr. Dave, or not. And so I know people in Second Life that I know them only as avatars, and like I know this really gorgeous, leggy redhead. She looks like a redhead Nicole Kidman, and she's one of Second Life's prime philosophers. She's really brilliant. I have no idea who she is in real life. She says she's a tech businesswoman in Portugal. Her name's Gwyneth Llewellyn. But really, her avatar is as real to me as many people that I know, especially people that I read about in the news or on the internet. It's like, this is a real person to me.
So she's a real person, and I suppose even your avatar becomes kind of a real person to you, that you identify with it.
Yeah, yeah, and I would have when I first started writing, Making of Second Life, or even just when I was reporting for the company for the blog, New World Notes, I would I had to figure out how to interact as a reporter. And I mostly was kind of coming in and seeing the fun aspects and the role-playing game aspects and kind of enjoyed it that way. For example, one of my avatars in the beginning was I got someone, a resident, to make him look like Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
So I had a Hunter S. Thompson avatar, and so I had a gun in one hand and a bottle of whiskey in another, and I'd go in and I'd interview people, but I'd be swearing and shooting off the gun, drinking and talking about hallucinations I'm seeing. And that seemed to help actually with the reporting, because it would put people at ease, and you know, they were more comfortable that I was part of the space as opposed to standoffish. Like, well, I see a lot of other reporters come in and they're very kind of, they're not acting like they're part of Second Life. They're acting like they're kind of, it's sort of beneath them. And you can see that in the writing.
Yeah. And so that just underscores how important that choice of identity is, that it really is going to have some impacts. Because in your in your book, you sort of, a theme that kind of runs through it are three principles or elements that you identified as characterizing Second Life, and you call those well, why don't you take us through those three? I think you know what I'm referring to here.
Yeah, yeah. So I sat down when I started the book and tried to figure out what are the three principles, or what are the main principles that guide Second Life and make it really potent and so successful as a world. I mean, because it's the growth rate in terms of people who try it out, and also to a lesser extent the amount of people that stay, has been really just kind of astounding. So one of the principles that makes Second Life unique, I think I call it bebop reality, because like I said in the beginning, everything in Second Life is user-created. So you have these building tools, so you can build pretty much any 3D object that you can imagine, from anything from like a wind-up watch that you wear on your wrist to a Battlestar ship that you can fly around in. And so you have this wide gamut of things you can create, and all of this is done dynamically, because what happens is Second Life is all streamed across the internet. And if you add content, if you create objects in Second Life, they appear right before people's eyes. It looks like your avatar is moving, they're stretching their hand out, and beams of light appear from your hand, and all of a sudden building blocks start appearing. They look like wooden building blocks, but then you can stretch them and give them different textures and shapes. You could add some functionality, because there's a programming system in Second Life. And that whole effect really leads to kind of what I call like a 3D jazz combo, because one person will build something cool, and right on the fly, right there, someone else will build something that kind of goes along with it. So you'll see this in the what are called the sandbox areas in Second Life. That's where you can have free-form building. So someone will build, for example, a giant like skyscraper, and that looks cool. And then another person will come along and create a giant like King Kong statue and then put it on the building. So all of a sudden you got not just a skyscraper, you got, you know, kind of a King Kong tableau. And that happens all the time in Second Life. So it's that's why I call it a bebop reality. It's sort of seeing reality as kind of this plastic improvisational space that you and everyone else is part of and sort of weaving in and out. And that's why also if you go into Second Life, you're not going to see any one particular type of avatar. Like if you go into World of Warcraft, you're going to see elves and, you know, gnomes and, you know, creatures that fit in the kind of Lord of the Rings sort of fantasy genre. But if you go into Second Life, you're going to see elves and gnomes and robots and vampires and furry animals and cartoon creatures and works of art. I mean, someone created an avatar that looks like Duchamp's nude descending a staircase, and another one created a character looks like a Picasso painting. So really, it's anything you can possibly imagine and as your identity. Talking about identity. I mean, you can be, you know, beyond, you know, male and female, or whether you want to be an attractive female or an attractive male, you don't even have to be human. So that's part of that whole bebop reality effect.
Yeah, it's a collaborative space, and people are like doing these jazz riffs. And one of the things that you likened it to that was meaningful for me, I guess because I live in the Bay Area, is the Burning Man Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Where people go out in the desert and build these incredibly creative structures only to destroy them at the end after the however long it goes, I guess about a week or so.
Yeah, about a week. I mentioned that in the book that Burning Man itself was a very strong influence on Philip Rosedale, who was the founder and the CEO for the first 5 years of Linden Lab when they created Second Life, and he wanted to kind of almost recreate the Burning Man experience, but kind of make it possible for anyone in the world to access if they had a computer and broadband.
Okay. Getting on to your second principle, it really underscores why identity becomes so important. So go ahead and talk about that one.
Are you, as far as impression society?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so what I'm saying there is I think Second Life is not a consumerist society or a capitalist society. You know how we kind of describe societies with sort of their kind of leitmotif. And with Second Life, I think it's based on impression. And impression in two ways. Impression in the sense of doing stuff, creating content, and doing things in Second Life that is truly impressive. It is really cool, and it shows a lot of creativity and ability with the building tools. And that's really kind of the gold standard of people that are recognized as kind of thought leaders in Second Life. And also impression in the sense of longevity, that you show that you're here kind of to be part of the community and contribute to it and keep coming back to it. Because creating accounts in Second Life is free. So there's actually been millions of people who've tried it. And about a million or so actually stay. So it's kind of this... I think the drop-off rate's about 90% for lots of reasons, and it is a very challenging space. And so if you can show that you're there to, you know, for the long haul and you're willing to get over the learning curve, then that's kind of also a gold standard. So, and it's very similar to Burning Man with this whole impression society that, you know, you show up at Burning Man and you know, you're half naked and nobody knows who you are, and they don't encourage people to kind of bring, you know, corporate trademarks and things like that to Burning Man, and really it's all about what you can build and what kind of contributions you can bring to the temporary community. So very similar, I think, in Second Life. So that's the second principle. That's the impression society. The third principle is what I call mirrored flourishing, and that's the sense and the belief that is very strong in the Second Life community, that what you do as a Second Life avatar should have a direct and generally positive influence on your real life. So this is very different from a traditional online game like World of Warcraft, where it's exactly the opposite. The more you spend playing a game like World of Warcraft, accomplishing tasks, getting treasure, killing monsters, and so on, you know, the kind of the assumption is you're going to get you're going to be on your computer longer, and you're going to get fatter, and you're going to get more antisocial, and you're going to kind of lose, excuse me, you're going to lose ties with the outside world. Where in Second Life, there's so many stories and they become kind of mythical stories or almost folklore to Second Life users of people in Second Life that have drastically changed their life because of being in Second Life, either because they've started businesses or they've created a circle of friends from around the world that's actually carried over into the real world. And that's kind of the thing, is that's almost the expectation that's going to happen. I write about this in the book. One of the first people I met in Second Life in 2003 was this woman named Catherine Omega. And in Second Life, Catherine Omega is this very glamorous kind of cyberpunk chick who was building a mansion with a cable car and a really beautiful mansion by the sea. And I started talking to her about it, and it turns out she was building it while she was homeless in real life. She was squatting in an abandoned apartment building because she got kicked out of her living space. And so she was squatting for a while, but she was smart enough to find an exposed power line to get electricity and a coffee can to get wireless internet, and really just amazing hacker girl. And so she was homeless while she was building this mansion. But the thing is, because of her skills as a builder and a scripter, she started getting paid by people. People started hiring her to do scripting in Second Life, and she started doing it for a living, and that helped her get out of her homeless situation.
And there are many similar wonderful examples of what you call mirrored flourishing in the book. When you first introduced that term early on in the book, I didn't quite get it, but as I moved through the book and I saw example after example, it became really clear what you were talking about. That's great. True for all three of those dynamics.
Yeah.
Now, I had known about Second Life for several years, and yet I was reluctant to get involved because I feel so busy in my first life.
Yeah.
Are the people who hang out there folks with lots of time on their hands or what? Or does it replace maybe television or other activities? I mean, you know, you were sort of touching on that whole thing of, you know, kind of getting lost in a video game type space versus something that has some value.
Well, if you look at the active user base, like the hardcore users, it's about 550,000 right now, and about 1.2 million, I think, that are less active. And if you look at the active users, the average usage time, I think it's about 45 to 50 hours a month. Which is really, it's about an hour and a half a day, which is about the same time most people watch television. And the surveys I've seen, I mentioned one from a marketing company that's looked at Second Life behavior. It's what happens is the majority of people start watching television less. So Second Life has supplanted kind of this passive entertainment where they put themselves in Second Life. And most people are kind of there to go to parties and socialize and dance and things like that, you know, meet people, flirt, romance, all of that. So really what they're doing is sort of putting themselves in an interactive kind of TV show where they're one of the characters and they have some authorship and agency about what they're going to do in this unfolding story. And there's always dramas, you know, it's more like a 3D immersive version of Friends or something, because people are constantly hooking up and having arguments over, you know, different love triangles and things like that on the kind of social gamer aspect of it. And the other thing is, too, is just a lot of people are doing it for practical uses. So you have right now, I think it's about 20,000 people that make an income on some level or another from Second Life, because this is another thing we should cover, is there's an internal currency called linen dollars. So you can exchange those linen dollars for U.S. dollars. And that's how you can have an internal currency or an internal economy where you're selling fashion, and fashion is probably the most popular of the industries, vehicles, games, and the people that sell these things, they can cash out and they can draw a real income from it, and you have people making upwards of $5,000 a month. So for folks like that, it's actually part of their work. So there's that level, and then there's all these applications that people are coming up with for real world activities. So there's actually a lot of architects that are using it as a design platform instead of like AutoCAD or something which is non-interactive. They're using it to actually create buildings that are being made in real life. I just talked to a woman who is an architect who's put together a contest that is designing a sustainable architecture that is going to be built in China and Hawaii. And she's building it, and the contest is being conducted in Second Life. So you have people doing that. So it really runs a gamut. I mean, that's kind of a question that happens a lot when I've talked about it in the media. People kind of assume it's sort of like The Sims or something like that, where they think, well, you're just going in to flirt and, you know, kind of socialize as an avatar. And that's a strong part of it, but then there's many, many other levels beyond that.
And probably most people imagine sort of pimply-faced teenagers as being the dominant kind of citizen there, but actually isn't the average age quite a bit older than that?
Yeah, the median age is 32. So I think, yeah, like the largest cohort is 32 to 39. And there's a like a 18 to 24 that's fairly strong, but it definitely skews older in comparison to other virtual worlds. Most virtual worlds are really popular with teenagers or even younger. Like there's one called Club Penguin, which is for kids, say, you know, 8 to 10 years old. But yeah, World of Warcraft is kind of, or I'm sorry, World of Warcraft is more skewing kind of college age, where Second Life is sort of what happens when you graduate from all of that. I see games like World of Warcraft sort of like the training wheels for this metaverse, which kind of Second Life is called, described as the metaverse, which is based on a concept from Neal Stephenson, the author of the kind of classic cyberpunk novel Snow Crash.
Yeah, one of my favorite books.
Yeah, awesome book. And sort of the a strong influence on Second Life, and kind of also a strong influence on the idea that 3D worlds like Second Life are going to become the next generation of the internet. And so there's a lot of people that are kind of seeing it that way. There's futurists and so on developing Second Life with that in mind.
Okay. Let me ask you, what percentage of your own waking life is spent in virtual reality?
It really varies. I mean, ironically, I spent almost very little time in Second Life while I was writing the book about Second Life. But on average, it goes from, I'd say, 10 to 20 hours a week.
Okay.
So I'll find stories to write about on my blog, and I'll go sometimes for just fun to hang out and explore. But it can get very overwhelming for me because there's just so much stuff going on that's really fascinating and cool. I go in for like 15 minutes and I'll have three stories that I could write about immediately that are really amazing and I want to tell the world about. So it's sort of, it feels like diving into this just kind of overwhelming storm of creativity.
Yeah, I'm surprised that there aren't more podcasts about Second Life, because your blog is wonderful. It's like an extension of your book. But I did a podcast search, and I found only two podcasts.
There's actually a lot more. Let me see if I can find it. There's a fairly large podcast network of podcasts devoted around Second Life.
Adam Curry?
Adam Curry discovered Second Life a couple years ago. So yes, he started doing podcasts from within Second Life. And because he's so popular in the podcast community, that brought in dozens of other podcasters. And they've been doing podcasts from Second Life. So,
okay, we'll talk about that more offline. Yeah. I want to come back to this whole psychological dimension. And I want to run by you kind of a rant that I received from one of my listeners, who I respect, a very bright woman who is a regular listener, and who I made the mistake of assuming that she would be in Second Life just because she had sort of an avatar sounding name for her sort of online identity. And she wrote back to me, she said, "Oh no, I'm the anti-denizen. That kind of thing holds absolutely no appeal for me. I'm an art historian because I love materiality. I like textures and surfaces and feeling the world. It took me a long time to wear dishwashing gloves when I was doing dishes because I don't like to feel separated from the dishes and soap and water. And I still cannot wear sunglasses because I feel like I'm in a bubble when I do. I like actually hanging out with my friends and having drinks and dinner or walking around to new places and swimming in the ocean. I'm also pretty much a radical leftist, not a liberal, mind you, a leftist. I'm idealistic, and nothing bothers me more than the fact that people are choosing a virtual life that is still predicated on our current destructive economy. An economy, by the way, that drives many people to want to have a virtual life. The whole thing is slipping into simulacra and representation, logos, brands, sound bites, avatars, MySpace pages, and I think it's a problem politically. I think community is meant to happen in the real streets where you have to deal with people, warts and all, and not just with a carefully tuned avatar whose facade is always facing you. In such a system, resistance is reduced to a performance. It becomes ironic. The whole thing is distressing to me. I guess I took the red pill. Plus, I like being outdoors. I don't even get outside as often as I would like because I'm working so much. I have to say that even if Second Life was perfect, indistinguishable from reality, I would still have issues with it on principle. It may be that we're currently the protagonists in a Cartesian evil demon simulators, but I don't know it. I do not believe that I could fully engage with anything I knew to be a falseness of the world. I also worry that this is some world we're going towards because our current system is making life on this planet unlivable. If they can just create people who are happy living in a virtual society, but where they will still exist in a commodity-driven capitalist system, then the environment can go to hell and a certain number of people can continue to labor and live in a replica of the way the world used to be. I know I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I really do think Second Life is a bad idea all around. It distresses me that you are there, but I hope you are like a teenager who is just experimenting. Now, I know I just gave you a lot to respond to there.
Well, that's a very strong and intelligent sort of, I think a strong and intelligent way of reacting to Second Life without having much direct experience with it. So there's some very valid points there, but I think they're based largely on kind of a secondhand knowledge of what's going on in Second Life. And I don't want to diminish what she's saying because, you know, this is definitely stuff that I've thought about a lot when I write the book and I write the blog. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's kind of what makes it worth writing about is it provokes such a strong reaction from people.
Yes.
I'd say more than anything, nobody is asserting that Second Life is going to replace the real world. What it really is, it's sort of an adjunct to the real world or to, you know, the physical material world. And, so there's kind of that. I mean, that's I take people through the naming of Second Life, where people actually came up with with the company Linden Lab came up with the name Second Life, and is actually a guy who works at Google now was the main guy who did that. And the whole concept was not to say, well, this is going to be an escape from the real world. What it was going to be, well, this is going to be just another channel of expression for you as a human being. There's all kinds of things that you present or you have to present in the real world that are going to kind of close off opportunities of expression that you would like to bring to the world, but you can't for various reasons. So there's very much a kind of a utopian aspect to that creation, with the idea being that when we come into the world, we don't have a lot of choice about, for example, our race, our gender, you know, where we live in the real world, our economic status. These are a lot of the things that we don't have much opportunity to define. And so the idea of being able to have a place where you can kind of start from scratch and do that and express some things is a very powerful part of the Second Life experience. And again, what's fascinating too is that you bring what you want and also bring the opportunities that you can't express in the real world into Second Life. But then also what's happening now is it'll go from Second Life back into the real world. That's the whole mirrored flourishing principle I'm talking about, where people are poor or they're in, you know, different walks of life that they would rather get out of. And this is a way of doing that, just because there is this kind of fluid economy where you can create content in Second Life, and that becomes a prototype or a revenue stream in itself. So I think that's an important principle to think about. The other thing to think about too is just how much political activity there is going on in Second Life.
Yes.
She says she skews decidedly leftward. Actually, there's a lot of activists in Second Life, real world activists, that use Second Life as a political expression platform, and they tend to skew left. So left or libertarian, let's say. So for example, the Daily Coast community did a they broadcast their yearly Coast convention in Second Life for people that could not go down. I think they had it in Las Vegas last year, and so they had this as a online community, as a, again an adjunct to the real world activism and the kind of political convention that they were holding. So there's a lot of that going on.
Okay. And, now, one of the things that you mentioned was gender shifting, and and I guess there are a lot of people playing with identity in that way. Give us a sense of how much that's going on, and what do you think that's about?
Yeah, the surveys I've seen, again, like marketing surveys or even academic surveys, it tends to, if I remember right, it's about 15 to 20% of people will have play with different genders in Second Life. So they're actually men playing women or vice versa.
I got the impression that it was more men playing women than women playing men.
Yeah, it seems to be that way. That's really interesting. I know few women that gender bend, though I know a lot of men because I've met them in the real world and they're like glamorous babes in Second Life. It turns out they're a guy. I mean, I met one of them. He was like this gorgeous, like elf babe princess. And then I met him. He's a 6'2" Texan with a mullet. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways and reasons they do that. It really, from individual to individual, they're like a lot of people. Like you say, mostly guys, they just like enjoying playing with a female character. They just like watching it and interacting with it and sort of shaping it. And there's a lot of interesting questions you can ask about why they're doing that. You can definitely have a feminist spin on it and say, well, you're just trying to control women. Or you can say, it's just kind of just fun. So, sort of a playing with dolls aspect of it. Other people are playing with gender because they're trying to express things that are more difficult to do in the real world. I've actually, just this week, I met someone who is transgender in real life. And she told me that she did that because she was having gender issues in the real world and kind of gender confusion. And she started changing her gender in Second Life from a male to a female.
And you tell a story too in there about somebody who is a woman who is African American and chose to be white in Second World because in Second Life and I guess she tried it both ways and just found that she experienced a lot less discrimination as a white avatar than she did as a black avatar.
Yeah, well, there's two stories that I mentioned as far as crossing race. There's one, a woman who had like kind of a – she was black in real life, but she had a kind of California blonde girl avatar. And she was telling me about a lot of the social pressures and kind of hoops that she did not have to jump through that she usually does in the real world. She said – she told me, like when I in the real world, I have to kind of make a good impression right away. I have to be very articulate and nice because otherwise, when she's out in society, people, especially whites, are going to make assumptions if she does not do that. So she was talking about the freedom of not having to worry about these things. She's just kind of she's there as herself, kind of paradoxically because she doesn't look like herself. She looks like a blonde girl, though in the real world she's African American. So there's that, and then there's also I wrote about a woman who's white in the real world. She's blonde girl in the real world, and in Second Life she tried out being a black woman in Second Life, sort of looked like Venus Williams, the tennis star, and was telling me about the different ways that people started reacting and interacting with her, where she said she, like her friends, a lot of her friends started getting cold about around her and started being standoffish and started saying strange things like, well, when are you going to go back to being you? And so kind of this thing, again, with the whole playing with identity, just kind of provoking this question of how people react to identity.
Yes, there's another great example of that in the book where, you know, there are various groups of people really that can benefit from being in this other world because of it, kind of disguising what they look like in real life. And you give the example of people who suffer from a certain physical disabilities. Talk about Wild Cunningham.
Yeah, Wild Cunningham is the name of an avatar who was actually controlled by generally 9 people who live in a care center in Massachusetts, who they're all profoundly handicapped. They're generally very little physical movement. They're in wheelchairs, a lot of paralysis, actually. And what they do is they interact in Second Life as an avatar named Wild Cunningham, and they go places and they say things based on kind of democratic vote. And even Wild Cunningham, the avatar, looks the look is very unique. He's like a orange and has bizarre hair. It's kind of like, because a lot of the people in the center in Massachusetts are white and others are black, so they kind of compromised and made him orange. And that was to me one of the first stories I wrote. That was sort of talking about a larger issue. I'd estimate there's about 10% of people in Second Life that are handicapped or physically disabled or psychologically disabled that kind of use Second Life as a way of interacting with people in the real world.
Yeah, just to fully paint the picture here, these people are in wheelchairs and such, and they're kind of gathered around a computer monitor, and their caretaker is sitting there kind of querying them, okay, where do you want your avatar to go now? What do you want your avatar to say? And they kind of, and she kind of tries to get the consensus of what they want.
Yeah, and I mentioned another story. There's one guy who comes into Second Life, and he just stands in one place. He doesn't move, and he just chats with people, and he's a really good conversationalist, and people enjoy talking with him. We found out later the reason why he doesn't move is he's totally paralyzed and he's typing with his feet.
Oh my goodness!
And that's how he communicates.
But this has opened up a whole world for him.
Yeah, very much so. So, I mean, so it's opened up again. This is that whole mirrored flourishing. It's opened up not only possibilities of human interaction, just being able to talk to kind of a human people, human, you know. See new human faces from all over the world on a regular basis, but also just that a lot of these folks are really talented and they haven't been able to show, for example, their artistic ability or even just kind of their social ability as far as being community organizers and leaders. And so they have this opportunity to do that in Second Life.
Well, for example, Asperger's syndrome people are in the world there and are able to flourish there. You tell a story about, I think it's Totoro Nino?
Yeah, Totoro. And again, this is another typical story. There tends to be a fair amount of people with Asperger's, which, as you know, is a kind of a mild form of autism. And they tend to be, in Second Life, very popular. Whereas in the real world, because of their Asperger's, they're kind of antisocial, at least from an outsider's perspective. But in Second Life, where so much of the conversation is based on text and chat, and they're able to be better communicators because they don't have to worry for the first time about all these invisible social cues, far as facial expressions, body language, that are not as important in Second Life.
And Totoro Nino, I'm trying to remember this person was very accomplished in Second Life.
Yeah, probably one of the more popular people in Second Life. She actually was, people built a shrine to her because she would, she was very well known for welcoming new users and helping them get their sea legs and, you know, just being very supportive, very matronly, kind of sort of a hip Mary Poppins, I think I described her. So that's very typical. There's so many people that are like that in Second Life, where they have very strong personalities, and again, they're able to bring out things that people, you know, 99% of the people that they meet in the real world have no idea that they have that in them. So yeah, that kind of relates to the email you got that you read from the woman, was just, you know, there's all these other avenues to consider that are coming out that, you know, we take for granted, most of us who are fortunate enough to be, you know, physically fully abled and able to interact with the whole of society in the outside world. But what about all the people who can't?
Yeah, I don't know if this is Totoro who I'm thinking of or another person who you described who's very social and welcoming and outgoing in Second Life, but said, you know, in real life, I don't have any friends because people are really turned off by the fact that that when I'm talking to them, I face the opposite direction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So,
well, you know, we should also talk about the experiment that you kind of led me through yesterday. We went into Second Life, and there's somebody there has developed something to kind of explore the world of schizophrenia.
Yeah, this was developed at UC Davis Medical, two doctors. What they did is they took the real-life transcripts of actual schizophrenics who would describe what their hallucinations look and feel like. And so they took the transcript and they converted a lot of these hallucinations into this demonstration in Second Life. So, for example, there's this one guy that they interviewed, this one schizophrenic who said he stopped shaving. And the reason he stopped shaving is because when he would start shaving and look at himself in the mirror, he'd see a death head. It would look like he was dead. So, you know, obviously just kind of drove him really insane. Or just had a really strong reaction to it. And so you actually, in this this simulation area, which looks like a hospital ward, you go in, and so you see that if you go toward a mirror, and also like signs change their shape, as we saw yesterday, and you also hear voices whispering in your head. And the whole effect is to create a as realistic as possible, a simulation of what having schizophrenia is like. And there's two intents. One of the intentions the UC Davis guys had for this was to show friends and loved ones of schizophrenics what the experience is like, because they had the impression that people were not grasping what schizophrenia is like. They kind of a lot of people sort of imagine schizophrenia being sort of, you know, like they're just hallucinating, like in the movies where, you know, you're seeing monsters flying around the room and things like that, where it's a much more subtle experience. And so they wanted to show what it's like, just so people can be more sympathetic, especially caregivers also, like nurses and stuff who work with schizophrenics. And the other idea they were working with, and I should follow up on this, I know that they were talking about it, was seeing if you can actually help schizophrenics by taking them through the simulation and sort of desensitizing them to the hallucinations, where, you know, if they see them represented on a computer screen as opposed to in their head, the hope is that they will be able to be resistant to them and identify them as hallucinations and just disregard them.
Well, it'd be really interesting to see how that turns out. And it reminds me of work that's being done with veterans from Iraq who are suffering from PTSD. And
right.
I actually did an interview with Skip Rizzo, psychologist at USC works with virtual environment, you know, sort of surround. You actually talk about some of that work in your book. You describe it as caves where you get into a kind of physical machine with goggles, etc., to really give that 3D sense. But it would seem that maybe even in Second Life environments could be constructed maybe to serve that same purpose of desensitizing.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they've done it with soldiers, but definitely there's people working in that space to do things like that.
Yeah. Well, let's see. There's so much more that we could talk about. I would love to go on and on. I wouldn't do a complete job here, though, if I didn't make some reference to the dark side of human psychology also shows up, you know, as somewhat of a Jungian. In Jungian psychology, we talk about the shadow. And for the yin, there's always the yang. And you refer to utopia at one point. Somehow the devil is in the utopia. You have what are called griefers. You want to comment on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's... Well, griefers, that's kind of a common reference in online worlds for people who cause grief, really, basically by using the tools of the game or the virtual world, in this case, to frustrate people. So, I mean, it could totally run the gamut from, like, attaching genitals to your head and chasing people around the room to, one interesting way, because what people do in Second Life often is to own land, and you can own property on your land, you can build homes on your land. And so what sometimes will happen is someone will build a really, really ugly house or like a really ugly sculpture that is neighboring, you know, so it's right in front of your neighbor's face and they kind of can't avoid it. And so you'll have this thing where people will start building walls so they don't have to look at their neighbor's ugly, you know, house or whatever. And often it'll be done intentionally, just trying to frustrate the neighbor or like try to get them to sell their property, which actually Linden Lab just came down with a regulation about that. So that's one example of griefing where someone is doing it kind of as a way to gain something, to gain like a land in this case. Though other times it's just... They do it kind of, they're just sort of as a asocial or kind of sociopathic fun.
Well, it's just like all those Star Trek episodes, isn't it, that we take our problems with us into space. Whether it's outer space or inner space, human nature will be human nature.
Yeah, that's what fascinates me as well. There are these utopian ideas around Second Life, and it was created with a lot of these ideas in mind. But yeah, we take our problems with us. We take our conflicts. I think with the griefers, you have a lot of people that tend to be really young guys who are not totally happy with their real life. And kind of traditional conception is they live in their parents' basement.
Right.
And so, you know, they're not happy with their life, so they're going to take it out on other people and make sure that they're miserable too. So you got that. Then you have, you know, people coming in with different political outlook. Coming in with different real world political outlooks, and that's going to lead to conflict. And so you're going to have all these sort of conflicts that come out that we think we carry with us into the from the real world in the Second Life, and that's this really fascinating dynamic. I mean, sometimes it causes conflict. I think it tends to, on balance, lead to kind of better social situations in Second Life, where you'll have people of all kinds of different value systems and political beliefs and so on, and they're able to more or less, on the whole, get along better in Second Life than they would in the real world. But that's the kind of fascinating tension.
Okay, and one of the little that's well said. One of the little alleys that we don't have time to go down today, but maybe I will in a future show, is the fact that there are psychologists and psychotherapists and counselors in Second Life, some of whom have hung out a shingle there.
Yeah, we did a search and found at least one or two, I think, people that represent themselves as accredited psychologists who are offering therapy.
Yeah, so I might try to chase one or two of them down and interview them to see what I can find out about what they're up to and what their experience has been. Well, as I say, you have a very wonderfully written book, and one of the things that struck me about your book is what is, regardless of what happens with Second Life down the line, whether it goes away or it flourishes or it takes over the world or takes over the internet, I think your book is going to be an amazing artifact 50 or 100 years from now.
Oh, thank you.
If somebody comes back and picks up this book, it's going to be terribly iconic of this particular point in time.
Oh, thanks very much, Dave. Appreciate that.
Sure. So, Wagner James Au, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, sir.
I dream that I'm in a gathering of strange-looking people. It's nighttime. The people seem to be in costumes of some sort. I begin chatting with a beautiful woman in a flowing, glowing white gown. I'm asking her about this place that we're in, and she offers to magically transport me to her private retreat. The scene dissolves, and I find myself on an outdoor dance floor. The dance floor is transparent, but with Tesla coil-like lightning bolts flashing beneath the glass. Like one of those globes with electric arcs that move towards your fingers as you grasp it. These beautiful electric arcs are startling in their beauty against the dark of the night. And the beautiful lady in white has materialized here. The ocean is gently lapping against the shore just beyond the dance floor. I dance with the beautiful woman, and then she goes over to a tree swing on the grass by the ocean. I watch her swing, and then notice a kind of porch swing for two nearby. I sit and we chat. Then she comes over and sits beside me. We're chatting some more. After a bit, she gets up and transforms into some kind of a furry animal, but we can still talk. Then she turns into a very large yellow dragon with big wings. Half jokingly, I ask if I can get on her back and go for a ride, not really expecting that such a thing will be possible. But she asks me to wait while she puts on a saddle. The saddle magically appears. I leap onto the saddle and she takes me flying through the starry sky, high over the dark ocean. We return to her grotto by the sea, and finally, it's time to say goodbye. I wistfully take my leave. Actually, this was not a dream, but rather one of my first experiences in Second Life. I had this virtual experience just before going to bed, and I was so exhilarated by the magic of it that I had difficulty getting to sleep, and the sleep that I did get that night was very light and had a kind of Second Life quality to it. After having resisted going into Second Life for so long, I'm for the moment a bit obsessed and infatuated with it, as is my nature. Here are some of my initial thoughts. First of all, I'm struck by just how dreamlike it is. Fantastical personas and events populate landscapes that are both familiar and strange. People and creatures come and go without logical sequence. Anything is possible. Interestingly, in the days after these initial experiences, I find certain things happening in waking life where I think, wow, this is a lot like Second Life. The Second Life experience can be viewed as a sort of waking dream, one that you can re-enter at will and more or less take it where you want, except that you don't really have control over the other characters and what they're going to do, and in that respect it's a lot like a nocturnal dream, because we usually don't have much sense of being able to control the other characters in our nighttime dreams either. So, I had a dream experience in which a beautiful woman appeared and took me under her wing on a magical journey. What's the difference whether this happened in a nighttime dream or in a nighttime session on my computer? Subjectively, I have to say not a whole lot of difference. Another way of looking at this is that I met a woman. Yes, I know it was a woman because we use microphones in addition to text chat, and she had a lovely female voice. And this woman invited me to spend a bit of time playing dolls with her. So just like two grown-up kids, we played dolls for a while, and it was fun, until I got tired of it and wanted to go to bed. Real bed, real sleep. As you'll remember from past episodes, folks who are into lucid dreaming say that a big part of the value of becoming lucid in the dream is to become more lucid in waking life. To become aware that one is in the waking dream, so to speak. Second Life seems to be having a similar impact on me, at least initially, of waking me up, in a sense, to the game of First Life. I see Second Life as a lab for the exploration of identity, Certainly, it is a place where you can try on different identities and experiment with them. I can even imagine therapeutic uses for practicing new sorts of adaptive behaviors in virtual reality as a rehearsal for bringing them into real life. And it's surprising how real the world of Second Life becomes while you're in it. On most of my recent explorations in Second Life, I've been accompanied by my friend Jerry Trumbull. We've been giving each other moral support as beginners in this new realm. His avatar has gone through some interesting changes, but is fairly stable at this point, with only minor cosmetic changes going on at present. So at this point, he's a fairly buff, burly-looking guy in a tuxedo with a red mohawk haircut. Increasingly, this is how I visualize him. He has a different name in Second Life, which I'll protect for now. But when I think of him in Second Life, there is the shift in my consciousness to his Second Life name and Second Life look. It's being great fun for us. In a way, it's like we're those two young guys again who are exploring young adulthood and having outrageous adventures together so many, many years ago at the University of Pennsylvania, an environment that was every bit as disorienting at that time as Second Life is to us now.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
As you might imagine, a lot of work goes into producing these podcasts, and there are four ways that come to mind that you can really help support this podcast. The first is through this new opportunity that we have for you to make contributions, where you can make a $20 contribution from your PayPal account into what is called My Top Spots, and you get to list a link to your favorite website or blog. And that may be your website or blog or somebody else's. Person mouses over on My Top Spots, they get to see a little message as well. And currently we have five contributors there. So I hope you will visit the right-hand side of our website at shrinkwrapradio.com and click on these and explore them. There's one that says Your Dreams Are Good. It's all about dream information. Another one is called Bliss Trips. Another is parenting advice from our own Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, who I've interviewed on the show. We have one on talent development and another on dreaming called Get the Dream Videos. So be sure to check those out. Now, another way, of course, that you can support us is through the transcription effort. If you look at the transcripts tab on our site, you'll see that there is a growing list of transcripts of just the interview portion. So if you want to help out with that effort, that certainly would be very helpful. Another way you can support us is by posting your positive reviews on iTunes if you haven't already done so. Those are very helpful to us in the long run as well. And finally, if you'll look at the GoDaddy link on our website where you'll find discount codes of Shrink 1, Shrink 2, Shrink 3, and more importantly, Shrink 25, which through the middle of the month of June will save you 25% on checkout at GoDaddy when you spend $100 or more.
Hi, Dr. Dave. My name's Jesse. I'm a fan of Shrink Wrap Radio from Orlando, Florida, and I'm beginning my master's training in mental health counseling at Rollins College here in the fall, and I just wanted to tell you that I absolutely love your show, and I hope you keep doing it for as long as possible, so keep it up, and thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jesse. You know how much I love those audio messages. Here's an email from one of our Top Spots donors from Get the Dream. Laura writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Everyone in our company is a big fan of the show. So when I heard about your new Top Spots advertising, we just had to participate. We create video programs designed to help people improve their lives. The technology that accomplishes this is a combination of brainwave entrainment with an electronic vision board. The entrainment audio takes the listener down to a suggestive alpha-theta brainwave state. Then a vision board presents affirmations and images to imprint on the subconscious mind. We tout that it only takes 20 minutes a day, even if you've never been able to meditate. We also create custom products for those customers who have more specific needs and goals that they're working on. Please keep up your great work. Warmest regards, Laura. P.S. There's an entrainment audio gift download on the site right now at www.getthedream.com, designed to promote restful sleep. Well, I'm going to need to check out that free sample myself, and maybe I should consider you folks for being guests on the show. Next, we have one more email here from Anna is the Man, who is a longtime listener and contributor, and he writes, I liked your interview with Fern Cohen about her book. I've been wondering about the quick and dirty approaches in mental health with drugs and short-term therapies, whether they do little more than squeeze people back into society's comfort zone without doing much healing. But while listening to Cohen, I began to appreciate more the approach of positive psychology. I mean, if you're going to work on improving your life, your relationships, and your feeling of self, how much good will it do to spend 5 sessions a week delving into what is wrong with you? Instead, I would place more hope on the positive approach, where the good points are brought forward and expanded upon. Nevertheless, it's a very good podcast, and he goes on to mention that he's reviewed it on his blog, which you'll find at http://annaisaman.blogspot.com, and Anna is a man is spelled annaisaman.blogspot.com. And he concludes, I hope all is well with you. Enjoy life, work, podcasts, and mostly your family, Anna. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype for ShrinkPod. You can use our MyChingo button to leave voice messages. And also our phone in the U.S. is 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Wagner James Au for speaking with us about his wonderful book on Second Life. And on next week's show, I'll be interviewing my longtime Sonoma State University colleague, Dr. Art Warmoth, about his interests in economics, barter systems, and learning communities. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.